Now, for a study this morning, though, I have an open topic, which is kind of scary because that allows my mind to work. And so I've been kind of studying on something. I can nearly guarantee you we probably never had a sermon from this place here called the Hinting Rabbi. And this is a really neat concept, and I feel like I'm just scratching the surface of this idea and this concept, the idea of the Hinting Rabbi. Now, I think it's going to change the way maybe you approach some of the verses that we've known our entire lives. To help facilitate this, I have seven questions I want to answer. And some are a little bit out there. Some may seem a little bit insignificant, but give me time. Question number one, what color is the stop sign? Question number two, do these words make you angry? Out of the mouths of babes and nursing infants, you have ordained strength. Does that passage upset you? Does that passage make you angry and want to kill somebody? Well, some people it did. I'll show you why. Number three, if two parallel lines are cut by a transversal, can you remember the rest of that and how that goes? We'll talk about that. Number four, how do you name a psalm? Number five, this is the big one. Did God forsake Jesus on the cross? Question number six, will Judge Judy allow you to testify about another's motives? And finally, question number seven, why did God make darkness fall upon the land during the crucifixion? So we're going to kind of use these questions to help facilitate our study this morning. But I think it's very important. There's kind of an underlying concept. What I have kind of stumbled upon, what I'm going to refer to today as the Hinting Rabbi. Before we go further, let's take opportunity, though, to go to God in the Word. What's a rabbi? We've heard that word before. It's something that's thrown around. Of course, it's something that we know. It's Jewish. But there's something that's very important, this concept of rabbi. Rabbi literally means my great one. That R-A-B is also R-A-V, sometimes spelled, and it means great in Hebrew. So it's the idea of someone who is great and a great teacher, someone who is renowned. Jesus explained himself as a teacher. And so as we get into the Greek, in the New Testament, you'll begin to see this word. And sometimes it is translated as master, sometimes it is translated as teacher, and sometimes rabbi. But the name rabbi, or the title of rabbi, was very important in the Jewish tradition. And it was a sign of honor when a Jew referred to their teacher as a rabbi. Rabbis in the time of Jesus were not like they are today. You still may hear the word rabbi so-and-so. Well, nowadays, they are kind of presiding over a particular synagogue or a particular congregation. But back in the time of Jesus, the rabbis were itinerants. They were nomads. They were like the traveling preachers. They would just kind of wander around from one location to another. Some have estimated that in the time of Jesus, there may have been hundreds of such rabbis that would travel throughout the land of Israel, teaching and expelling their form of understanding of the Old Testament. And so Jesus, as we think back to kind of his situation and his history, that's what he was. He was just a traveling teacher, and he would be way up in the north, up at Capernaum, and next thing you know, he'd be traveling down into Galilee, and he'd travel around Jerusalem, and then he'd go back up. He never traveled very far, but all throughout, Jesus just kind of wandered. He never had a home. He never had a kind of a base of operations. It seems that he would go back up to the north when he needed to get away from things. But they just kind of wandered around. Rabbis traveled across the land. They just taught whoever they could find. It was not uncommon for a rabbi to have three or four people that he would teach. A lot of times they would just meet up trees, and that's where the rabbi would teach and expound his knowledge of the scriptures. Rabbis were not allowed to charge. They could not do it for money. But they were dependent upon the hospitality of others. So now I think about some of those passages that we hear in the New Testament. Jesus tells his disciples when they began to kind of be itinerant rabbis in their own way. You know, don't take your food, don't take money, don't worry about it. People are going to take care of it. And that was the idea that in the Jewish custom, the rabbi was very revered and hospitality was the name of the game. Don't ever kid yourself. Jesus was a rabbi. And somehow I think we forget that because we don't really have a strong Jewish understanding. We are so far removed from that lifestyle. And I'll be honest with you, even Jews today are very far removed from what it was back in the old days. But these passages, every one of these lists someone referring to Jesus as Rabbi. And so there were his own disciples. Judas referred to him as Rabbi several times. Peter referred to him. Nicodemus referred to him. The scribes, the Pharisees, they all referred to Jesus. They recognized the fact that he was a rabbi. He was a teacher. And so I'm going to give you one, just kind of as a concept here. Matthew chapter 4, 18 and 20. And Jesus, walking by the Sea of Galilee, saw two brothers, Simon called Peter and Andrew his brother, casting a net into the sea, for they were fishermen. And then he said to them, "Follow me, and I will make you fishers of men." And they immediately left their nets and followed him. So this idea of following a rabbi, probably a little different than what we think about it. You notice when they left, when they agreed, they left their nets. They knew they weren't coming back. They were going to take off on the road. They were going to become an itinerant band following this rabbi, Jesus. Words of Nicodemus in John 3 and 2. This man came to Jesus by night and said to him, "Rabbi, we know that you are a teacher come from God, for no one can do these signs that you do unless God is with us." So that is from a member of the Sanhedrin court. That's Nicodemus. He's a ruler of the Jews. And he realized that Jesus was not only a rabbi, he was a rabbi, a teacher come from God. And so when he calls Jesus rabbi, that is a great sign of respect. Jesus was a rabbi. He was a teacher. And as a rabbi, he had a lot of things to teach and a lot of things to say. Jesus was very specific about his idea of a rabbi, though. In Matthew 23 and 8, he says, "But you do not be called rabbi, for one is your teacher, the Christ, and you are all brethren." The concept of following a rabbi is unlike anything really that we can wrap our heads around with our way of Western thinking. I suppose some have said it's like a master and an apprentice, and you just follow that person, you learn everything you can. But if I wanted to follow around a master teacher and be their apprentice, at 5 o'clock I'd go home. And I'd show up again at 8 in the morning, and we would talk about teaching, but that's it. That's not how it was with rabbis. When you followed a rabbi, they became your role model. In everything that they did, you attempted to emulate every facet of their life. You were with them 24/7, and you studied the way they talked, and the way they walked, and the way they ate, and the way they interacted with people. You tried to emulate everything that that rabbi did. And so Jesus says, don't call people rabbi. Don't try to be too much of a teacher, because he knew what would happen. You remember what happened in Corinth when people started associating too much with their teachers? Some said, "Well, I'm of Paul." And some said, "Well, no, I'm of Peter." And others said, "Well, no, I'm of Apollos." He said, that's not the way it's supposed to be. We're not supposed to associate with our teachers. We're supposed to associate all together in Christ, because we are all brethren. And so this concept of this rabbi relationship had to change a little bit. Because in the Jewish way of thinking, things were very different. Rabbis were not only teachers. They were role models for everything that occurred in life. Question number one. What color is a stop sign? You might think that's a crazy question. I would think anybody could answer that question. But I want to show you something, because this is important for the concept of understanding. I used to work with a teacher. She's a very interesting lady. She taught for about 30 years. The first 15 years of her teaching, she taught kindergarten and pre-K. The second part of her career, the last 15 years, she taught upper-level high school mathematics. I'm thinking, you don't see that combination very often. But she used to talk about this concept. She said in kindergarten, you got to be careful. You got to test these kids to see if they're developing the way they should. They said there's a difference between these two questions. What color is a stop sign? And what color is that? And the concept is, there's two different words, recall and recognition. And she says they're very, very similar, but you really got to think about it. If I show someone a color and I say, "All right, kindergartner, what color is that?" Then they can answer red. But if I don't give them this picture at all and I say, "What color is a stop sign?" Then what's that kiddo have to do? In their mind, that kiddo has to recall, in their mind's eye, what a stop sign is. And then they say, oh, a stop sign is red. There's a difference of what's called recall versus recognition. So put that in terms of the scriptures now. Do we recall scriptures or do we recognize scriptures? And so if we're to throw a passage up here, if I was to read a passage, you might say, oh yeah, that's from Matthew. Okay, that's recognition. And that's important. But it's also important to recall scriptures. To be able to pull the scriptures out from your own mind without any reference whatsoever and to know the scriptures. Recall and recognition. And so the rabbis were very proficient at getting kids to the level of recall. And they would train these kids from a very, very early age with the concept of repetition. In fact, this is one of the parts of the rabbinical law. One who repeats his lesson 100 times is not like him who repeats it 101 times. In other words, repeat, 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 repeat. And they would have these kids from a very, very early age recite the scriptures. And they would chant them. In fact, they would chant them so many times, out loud, by the way, over and over. It became a little phrase, they called it the chirping of the children. And they would say, you could walk by the synagogue and hear the chirping of the children. And that was the children reciting these passages out loud, over and over and over and over and over and over, until not only could they recognize the scriptures, they could also recall the scriptures from memory. And that was the job of the rabbis. That was part of their teaching style. The purpose of the rabbi was to take his disciples to even higher levels of understanding. Namely, he wanted to take them to the point of application. So I got some former teachers in the room, and some of y'all that may have done some time in college. You remember something called Bloom's Taxonomy? And it starts off real low, and then by the time you get to what's called analyzing, and you're trying to create things, application, those are higher level thinking skills. And I'm starting to figure out all this stuff that I learned in college about how to be a teacher. The rabbis have been doing it for hundreds of years, thousands of years, because that's what they did. That's the way they trained them. Question number two. Let me show you how this makes sense now. Let me ask you, do these words make you angry? Out of the mouths of babes and nursing infants, you have ordained strength. Does that make anybody want to fight? Does that upset anyone? It did the Jews. It did the chief priests and the scribes when Jesus said it to them. Because what would happen was the rabbis, they had this really good concept going on where they could quote scripture, just a little piece of it. And they expected their students to remember the rest. Let me show what I'm talking about. You might want to turn to Matthew chapter 21 if you've got a Bible. I don't have these passages on the screen this morning. But in Matthew 21, this is the last week of the life of Jesus. And so he enters into Jerusalem, the triumphal entry, Palm Sunday, as some people refer to it now. But Jesus goes to the temple. And he sees all these animals and these money changers that have just destroyed the sanctity of the temple. And Jesus begins to cleanse it. In fact, he starts flipping over tables. He begins to chase these animals and these people out of the temple. That is found in Matthew 21, verse 12. Jesus went into the temple of God and drove out all those who bought and sold in the temple and overturned the tables of the money changers and the seats of those who sold doves. Then he makes a statement. He said to them, it is written, my house shall be called a house of prayer, but you have made it a den of thieves. You notice he said, as it is written. There's two different passages there. Here's another little trick the rabbis used to do. If they were talking about the prophets, they would oftentimes combine prophecies. And so they would take something from Jeremiah and something from Isaiah. And what do the kids nowadays call it? A mashup. They put the two things together. Kind of like they did in Acts chapter 2 when Peter's preaching on the day of Pentecost. And he starts quoting from the prophet Joel. And it also has some Isaiah thrown in there. They like to do that with the prophets. And that's just what Jesus did. He kind of combined these two ideas. And then he got to verse 14. It said, then the blind and the lame came to him in the temple, and he healed them. But when the chief priests and scribes saw the wonderful things that he did, and the children crying out in the temple and saying, Hosanna to the Son of David, they were indignant and said to him, do you hear what these are saying? So Jesus, do you hear what these people, how these children are comparing you to the Son of David? And Jesus said to them, yes. Have you never read, out of the mouths of babes and nursing infants, you have perfected praise? This is another translation of it. Out of the mouths of babes and nursing infants, you have ordained strength. That sound like anything to get upset about? That was probably the straw that broke the camel's back. That made the Jews so mad. That made the chief priest and the scribes so mad. But if you don't know the rest of the passage, you probably don't know why. Because what Jesus was doing as the rabbi, he was dropping a hint. You know where that passage comes from? It comes from Psalm 8. So here we go. One teaching method of the rabbis of the day was to quote the first line of a passage. They just say the first word, the first couple of lines. They would get a hint, and they would expect the students to remember the rest. So when we read that passage, out of the mouths of babes and nursing infants, you have perfected praise, or have ordained strength. It doesn't sound that bad, right? It doesn't sound like he's being confrontational. Oh, but Jesus was. In latter years, this word had become known in the rabbinical world as, and I don't know how to pronounce it, R-E-M-E-Z, Remez, I don't know how it's pronounced, which literally means hints. Hints would be given. They would say one line, and maybe you're supposed to know the rest. And you're supposed to be able to recall that from your memory, and then be able to apply that passage to the current situation. Real interesting. I put this in box right here. I want to really note this. The astute student was not only expected to recall the remainder of the passage, but also look for applications to their current situation. So the rabbi would drop a hint. The rabbi would say the first line, and then the student was to say, oh yeah, I remember the rest of that passage, and then figure out how it applied. So how does this work in Psalm 8, 1 and 2? Jesus says, out of the mouths of babes and nursing infants, as soon as they heard that, you know what every Jew in the temple did that had been trained by a rabbi? Their mind instantly went to Psalm 8, which says, O Lord, our Lord, how excellent is your name in all the earth, who have set your glory above the heavens. Out of the mouth of babes and nursing infants, you have ordained strength. That's where Jesus stopped, right? Keep reading. Because of your enemies, that you may silence the enemy and the avenger. So what did Jesus mean when he said, have you never read, out of the mouths of babes and nursing infants, you have perfected praise? And as he turned and walked off, you know what he was saying? He was saying, oh, y'all Jews, you're supposed to know the rest of that verse. You're supposed to know the rest of the story. And in fact, what he was doing, in kind of an indirect, almost passive-aggressive way, what Jesus was saying was, hey, you chief priests, you scribes, you are the enemy and the avenger. Because he knew they knew the rest of that passage. See, Jesus dropped a little hint. R-E-M-E-Z, remez. He dropped a hint, and then he turned and walked out. Isn't that a good way to do it? When you talk about a passive-aggressive form of calling somebody out. Those Jews knew exactly what the next phrase of that psalm was. And so when they heard, out of the mouths of babes and nursing infants you have ordained strength, their mind went, because of your enemies. He was calling the chief priests and the scribes the enemies and the avengers. Question number 3. I have two parallel lines cut by transversal. Y'all remember that from high school geometry? I figured out that teachers almost do that instinctively. Because I get sick and tired of giving kids the answers. Because they don't know how to do a problem. The first thing they want to do is they want me to go do it for them. Well, that doesn't help anybody. I want them to learn to think for themselves. So I do this all the time. I'll just say, well, two parallel lines are cut by transversal. I'll jot them in. And then it's up to them to remember the rest. Hopefully. Hopefully they'll go back and study on their notes and they'll find how to do the passage. We do that all the time because we don't want to constantly have to tell people what to do. We want them to learn to think for themselves. That is the concept of remez, of hinting. It's exactly what Jesus did. Jesus was the hinting rabbi. He would drop a line here, drop a line there, and expect them to know the rest. There are several examples of this remez or hinting found in the words of Jesus. So I've already given you one. Let me give you another one real quick. Matthew 11, verses 4 through 6. A couple of people had came to him. They were disciples of John the Baptist. John was now in prison. And they sent him to him. And they said, are you the one we should follow? And Jesus answered and said to them, go and tell John the things which you hear and see. The blind see and the lame walk. The lepers are cleansed and the deaf hear. The dead are raised up and the poor have the gospel preached to them. And blessed is he who is not offended because of me. You know every one of these is a hint. Every one of these little passages, these little phrases, is a hint. Jesus combined Isaiah's prophecy from chapter 29, 35, 42, and 61. He made four different hints to the prophecy of Isaiah. And so now what was John the Baptist expected to do? He was expected to hear that word and recite the rest of the passage. That's what remez is. That's what the hinting rabbi was trying to accomplish. There's a Bible scholar by the name of C.H. Dodd. He was at Cambridge over in England. So he kind of one of the top Old Testament scholars in words at this time. He says this method included first a selection of certain large sections of the Old Testament scriptures, especially from Isaiah, Jeremiah, and certain minor prophets, and from the Psalms. These sections were understood as wholes, and particular verses or sentences were quoted from them rather as pointers to the whole context, rather than as constituting testimonies in and for themselves. In other words, the first line would represent the entire passage. And so as you would make a statement as a hinting rabbi, he would just have to drop a couple words. And the Bible student was expected to have the rest of the passage memorized. And the first thing I thought about that is, wow, I do not have enough knowledge of the Scriptures. I do not understand the Scriptures well enough. And I wonder if any of us truly understand the Scriptures well enough to pick up on all these little hints that are being dropped by the rabbi. Question number four. How do you name a song? Do you know in the time of Jesus, you know it was common, it was the custom to just name a psalm by its opening line? In fact, there's like two different numberings of the psalms anyway that are in history. We like to call the 23rd psalm, right? Other people think that's the 22nd psalm because they're all numbered differently. The rabbis didn't walk around and say, well, go to Psalm 23. You know how they refer to Psalm 23? They would say, the Lord is my shepherd, and I shall not want. And then the Bible student was expected then to recite, to recall from memory the remainder of the psalm. It wasn't called Psalm 23. It wasn't called Psalm 118, verse 5. That was all done in later times. They were just expected to recall it from memory. How do you name a psalm? By the first couple of lines. And I got to think about that. That's usually the way we do it in just naming songs nowadays. Usually you'll hear it repeated in the song, or sometimes the first word of the song is the name of the song. I was thinking about the Beatles driving in. I can hear Paul McCartney sitting down and singing, the first word is Yesterday. Well, that's the name of the song. Doesn't always work like that, but sometimes it does. Then I get real frustrated. When I was in school, there's a song by a group called Green Day. And you'll hear it all the time now because it's pretty good graduation type song. For the longest time, I thought it was called I Hope You Have the Time of Your Life. I don't know if you've heard that song or not. That's not its name. It's called Good Riddance. I don't even know where that comes from. It's not even in the song. But you can name a song however you want to. But the psalmists, back in the time of Jesus, they like to name the song by the first couple lines. Kind of interesting. Question five. Here we go. Did God forsake Jesus on the cross? You know, that is a question that has been asked forever. And it's a question that if we say yes, boy, it sure opens up some doctrinal issues. Because we sang a song this morning about abide with me. Well, if we expect God to abide with us, then how could he have forsaken Jesus on the cross? But that's sure what it seems like, right? Isn't that what it seems like from the words of Jesus in Matthew 27 and 46? Jesus cries out from the cross. He says, my God, why have you forsaken me? That sure sounds like God forsook Jesus on the cross, doesn't it? But I think if we do a little bit more study, we realize that Jesus was the hinting rabbi. I don't think that's what it was at all. Jesus is the hinting rabbi. Was this a prayer? You know, some people think it is. Some people will think that this is a prayer, that Jesus is praying from the cross. In fact, if you Google prayers of Jesus, some lists will have Matthew 27, 46 in that list. Preachers might say, Jesus prayed from the cross. My God, why have you forsaken me? I don't think that's true. I don't think that is a prayer. I don't think Jesus was praying to God, saying, why have you forsaken me? Many will say yes, though. But I want you to notice, in every list of prayers where Jesus was recorded, the words that he spoke, it always started with Father. Every one of his prayers was addressed to Father. In the Greek, that's P-A-T-E-R. Before too long, the Germans changed that to a V, V-A-T-E-R. And before too long, the V sounded so much like an F, the English changed it to F-A-T-E-R, and for good measure threw in an H. And that's where we get Father from. And so this idea of all the prayers were addressed to the Father. It was not my God. That was, in fact, the Bible even says he spoke it in Aramaic, which was his native language that he had learned from a child. It sounds kind of like Elijah, I guess. Because some of the people around the cross said, oh, I think he's calling for Elijah or one of the prophets. They didn't even understand what he meant. But Jesus cried out. He said, my God, why have you forsaken me? And so a lot of people are taking that, oh, God forsook Jesus on the cross. I don't believe that's the case whatsoever. Did you know that Jesus was simply reciting the first line of Psalm 22? Do you know the rest of it? Because when Jesus said it to the crowd, anyone who was any Jew whatsoever, anyone that had been trained by the rabbis, had to know, or should have known, the remainder of the text. When Jesus says, my God, why have you forsaken me? He wasn't praying. I don't believe so. He was quoting Psalm 22, which was written by King David. He's just quoting the words of David. But everyone else should have now known there's something about the rest of that psalm. So read Psalm 22 one time. I'm going to pull a couple verses out for you. What I suggest is that Jesus was given one more powerful sermon from the cross. And I think this last powerful sermon came from the fact that in his native tongue, Aramaic, Jesus quoted the first line of Psalm 22. And everyone who had been trained by the rabbis knew what that meant. They were supposed to recall the rest of the passage and then look for ways to make applications to their current situation. And Psalm 22 is now referred to as one of the great messianic psalms because of verses like this. Verse 16, they pierced my hands and my feet. Now remember, this is David talking. This is David talking about something completely different. David didn't even know probably what he is prophesying about. They pierced my hands and my feet. I can count all my bones. They look and stare at me. They divided my garments among them, and for my clothing they cast lots. So when Jesus cries out, my God, why have you forsaken me? You know what he's doing? He's hinting. He's dropping a hint. And everybody should have then thought about the rest of Psalm 22 and all the messianic prophecies that were found in Psalm 22. The learned Jew would have realized that Jesus, by quoting from Psalm 22 when he was on the cross, was giving us the greatest sermon of all. He was making the connection that he was the Messiah. He was the promised one. That's what that passage, I believe, means. Question 6. Would Judge Judy like to testify about another's motives? Absolutely not. They'll try to get up there on stand and say, well, they thought that I was going to, and she'll stop them right there. She said, you can't tell me what they thought. She said, that calls for the operation of their mind, and you can't do that. You can tell me what they said. You can tell me what you heard. You can tell me what you read, but you cannot tell me what someone else was thinking. That calls for the operation of their mind. I suggest to you this morning, we cannot put ourselves in the position of trying to think like God either, for that's not possible. We cannot call for the operation of God's mind. We must be careful adding meaning to a situation that is not warranted. Be very careful of that. Which leads me to question 7. Well, I'm going to tell you this one, Isaiah 55. This is the passage. For my thoughts are not your thoughts, nor are your ways my ways, says the Lord. For as the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways, and my thoughts than your thoughts. We cannot put ourselves in the operation of God's mind. Now that leads me to question 7. Why did God make darkness fall upon the land during the crucifixion? As recorded in Matthew 27. Why did God make it dark? And you know what, I've heard some deep things. I've probably even said them from this pulpit. But I don't believe we ought to now. I've heard things like, oh, it was just so bad. God just couldn't stand to watch it, so he turned his back. And that's what brought the darkness. That may be true, I don't know. Sounds good. Sounds very poetic, but it's not scriptural. Some people say God just could not stand to see the pain of his son suffering on the cross, so he darkened the sky so he couldn't see it. Maybe that's true. I don't know. But it's not scriptural. And I don't believe it's something that we should say. We need to be very, very careful when we start applying meaning and trying to get into the operation of God's mind. Do you know why God made the darkness fall upon the land during the crucifixion? Because he wanted to. And that's about all we can say. And I believe we shouldn't go out on limbs and start adding this poetic justice and say, well, I think we can do this and this, and God did this, and this is why. You better be careful of that. Don't add meaning to things that we don't have any knowledge of. Why did God make darkness fall upon the land? Because it was his prerogative, and that's what he wanted to do. Maybe it was to protect Jesus. Maybe it was because he didn't want to see it. But we shouldn't go around saying that, because that is not scriptural, and we need to be careful of that. Be careful assigning meaning to this situation that calls for the operation of God's mind, no matter how plausible it sounds, no matter how good it sounds. Be careful. And there's all sorts of situations we can recall that are similar to that. Don't add to the meaning of scriptures unless you can prove it in the scriptures. Conclusion. Jesus was the teaching rabbi. And he appears to use this teaching form of remez, this idea of dropping a hint. And this idea was that you could use the first line of a passage, especially one of the Psalms, and the disciple would be expected to know the remainder of the psalm and be able to make applications to the situation. I don't believe Jesus was praying, my God, why have you forsaken me? I don't believe that's the prayer that Jesus was making. I don't believe it was a prayer. I believe that he was simply reciting the words of David from Psalm 22. And in doing so, they should have been able to make applications. And the people that heard that should have realized that Psalm 22 is a messianic prophecy. And they were realizing that that was the final sermon from the cross, that Jesus was now saying, I am the Christ. I am the one. Look at my hands. They have pierced me. He was making the connection that he was the Messiah that David had prophesied about in Psalm 22. And finally, be careful assigning meaning to passages that can't be proved in the scriptures. No matter how good it sounds, no matter how beautiful it sounds, no matter how poetic it sounds, we cannot do things that call for the operation of God's mind. We can't testify to that. We can only testify to what we've seen and what we've heard.